Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. We thank you for joining us this morning. Today is Monday, the 12th of June, 2006, and it is approximately 7:41 and 30 seconds. We welcome you and hope that all is well with you this morning. This morning, we will continue our ongoing conversation about situations and news that will inform and help you as you start your day or as you start your week. Before we begin our program in a formal way, let me remind you that if you have announcements or information to share with the community, that this is a great opportunity and a great forum to get your message out. Send us a message here at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th, and we will certainly get it on the air. To that note, let me remind those of you who are interested that on Sunday, June 18th, Books to Prisoners will host a benefit film showing and prisoner letter writing party from 4 to 8 p.m. at the Red and Black Cafe, which is located at 2138 Southeast Division in Portland. Come and learn about North American political prisoners from 4 to 6 p.m. and write a letter or a birthday card to one of them. Then watch and discuss Books Not Bars, a film about juvenile incarceration in this country. Following the movie, the band Rag and Bone Men will get you dancing. A donation of $5 or a dictionary is requested. All proceeds go to Portland Books to Prisoners and Books to Oregon Prisons. For more information, please get your pencil. The email address is pdxbookstopprisoners@riseup.net. Or let me advise you to visit the website, which is www.bookstooregonprisoners.net. org. The website again is one word, books2oregonprisoners.org. Again, this is a benefit film for the Books to Prisoners, which will take place on Sunday, June 18th. Let me remind you again, if there are announcements that you have to share, to give us a call here at KBOO, and we'll make sure that the information is shared with you. Certainly, there has been a lot that has been happening this week, and we'll get into some of that concerning the ongoing U.S. war in Iraq and potentially in Iran also. Today, we'll talk with a representative from the Fellowship of Reconciliation. He is their peace and disarmament staff person. And we'll also talk about bridging the gap between Islam and the West. But before we get to our program, why don't we say good morning to not only you, but I also want to say good morning to Celeste. Good morning, Celeste. Excellent. Well, do you have any other announcements to share for the good of the order?
No, actually, I don't have any new ones here. I did check my email, but I didn't have anything new to announce.
Okay. Well, let me remind our listeners that we here at the station are working with a new delay system. So it may cause some confusing if you called up and you might hear one thing on your earpiece, on your telephone, and something else on your radio. So when you call up this station to speak with us or to a guest, the engineer, wonderful Sir Richard, will put you on hold. Mm-hmm. And then when you hear Celeste's wonderful voice saying, good morning, listener, you are on.
Cecil's melodious tones.
Yes.
Yes.
That you are on the air.
Yeah, you are on
the
air.
That is your signal to
turn that radio down.
Way down.
Put your ear to the phone and let that be your source for sound.
Well, as we begin this week, there's been lots of things that have been happening, and thinking of a segue to our conversation this morning, but it's coming, you know. The segue is...
I think mine got washed away with the rain. I know I had a segue. That's usually my strength.
But two things I wanted to note. One, and then I'll do the segue. Today is June 12th, 2006. And today is the anniversary of the assassination of Medgar Evers.
Oh, my, yes.
In 1963.
You know, I don't know that this is necessarily going to provide a segue, but it's interesting to note how much work had gone into both exciting the imaginations and the dreams of a people for freedom and achieving some of those dreams, some of those goals. And then you look now and you wonder how much has eroded. And the sad thing about it is, for a lot of us, it's turned into both a class and a race distinction that drives a lot of our politics and our activities and undermines some of the gaps between various divisions and groups within the country. And hearing that, in some ways, I'm a little saddened because I'm old enough to know what the struggle is and have gone through some of that personally, but I'm young enough to see that we have so much still to accomplish.
There is so much still to accomplish, a lot of work ahead of us. But also, as often has been noted, that we continue our struggle because we are so thankful for the work of those who went before and laid the foundation.
I'm chuckling because I also think, yeah, we continue to struggle because we're hardwired to do so. not inclined to want to give up, always looking for a way to make the connection, to make peace and reality real for everyone, peace and equality real for everyone.
Okay. And, this is the segue, right? Peace and equality. And this is the real segue that I thought about. Mm-hmm. This week in Portland has been a week of activities, I guess culminating with the parade on, Rose Parade on Saturday, but also for our guests and for listeners who are unfamiliar with a lot of that goes on in Portland during this time of year. There's a big festival, there's parades, but there's also this strange pseudo-patriotic fervor that comes up. And part of the Rose Festival activity is this bowing down before the U.S. militarism.
I thought you were going to say bowing down before the roses.
Oh, well, that too.
Okay, but yeah.
But there's the fleet comes into town,
yeah,
and sailors from mm-hmm. naval.
Sailors from all around our perimeters, I guess I say, because I've seen, you know, Canadian soldiers and sailors and what have you.
And in this time where we are, this nation is engaged in war, there's a people are driving the forces of patriotic fever and how we should support these people in their endeavors. But there are all ways in which we can begin to question U.S. military power and U.S. military wisdom. And joining us is someone who has worked for many years in terms of peace and disarmament. I assume is sometimes a lonely work, but also someone who's been faithful working with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is a national, international organization of people who are concerned about peace and justice. And why don't you introduce our guest?
Well, we have joining us today, as Cecil has said, Ibrahim Ramey, who is of the Fellowship of Reconciliation and Peace Disarmament Coordinator. His activism for social change began in 1968, the year of the assassinations of both Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, and the year of the Tet Offensive. And that was the beginning of the end of the U.S. involvement in Indochina. During this year, as a second-year university student, he resigned from the Reserve Officers Training Corps, ROTC, program at the University of Pennsylvania, and picked up the works of Ho Chi Minh and Malcolm X, and submerged himself in radical politics of the Black Liberation Movement. During this time, he discovered an interest in mass media, worked as an announcer for campus radio, and writing a column for the Daily Pennsylvanian School Newspaper. After college, Ibrahim developed an experience and an insight as an organizer for African liberation activities while serving as a member of the staff for the National Black Economic Development Conference. This international work continued when he was appointed to represent the Black Economic Development Conference, BEDC, as the group's non-governmental organization representative to the United Nations the following year. Then he joined the staff of the New York City-based Pan-African Skills Project, and this is a group that is sponsored by African-American church leaders, where he worked as a special attaché to the embassy of the Republic of Tanzania in Washington, D.C., and he assisted in the recruitment and orientation of professional and technical workers for service to the development program, and he represented the organization as a delegate to the 6th Pan-African Congress held in Dar es Salaam in 74. He continued his affiliation with the Pan-African group through the 70s and early 80s and is currently working on a project to archive the historical materials from the Pan-African Skills Project. He has also served as a member of the War Resisters League and embraced the religion of Islam in 1993 and joined the Fellowship of Reconciliation in 95. He's a board member of Muslim Peace Fellowship and a contributing editor of its newsletter. Also serves on local and national committees for the American Friends Service Committee, board of directors for the Center on Conscience and War, and the Central Campaign for Conscientious Objectors. So without further ado, we will welcome our guest. Good morning.
Well, good morning to you, Celeste, and hello again to my brother Cecil Prescott, whom I haven't seen in a few years, but the voice would be totally undeniably clear and identifiable, even if I can't see your face, Cecil. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's good to hear from you, and good that you continuing this faithful, I assume, often lonely work. Busy time of activities for you?
Well, yes, it is. Unfortunately, the organization that I work for is going to discontinue my staff position and the disarmament program on the last day of June of this year. But my work over the last 11 years and 2 months will continue in other ways, and I'll be working with organizations with whom I've developed some relationship and also with communities, hopefully, that I've developed relationship with, and will continue to promote the idea that the refusal to fight in wars, that the struggle for justice for black and brown and all oppressed people, and that the struggle for peace and economic justice is a struggle that all of us need to be involved with. So I'm going to still at this ripe old age, and when Celeste was reading the bio, I say, well, people are going to kind of pick up that, on the fact that I'm not 30 anymore, but that struggle will continue, and it's been a blessing to be able to do it for 11 years plus here at FOR.
Well, we certainly appreciate your work and your continuing effort. As Celeste was reading your bio, I said, my gosh, he's done a lot, and he's only 35, so... one of the reasons we wanted you here is part of an ongoing conversation we've been having in this station, trying to figure out this strange new world we find ourselves in. And as you are well aware of, and perhaps you can give us some perspective in terms of your work, I'm speaking particularly in terms of the increased awareness of Islam in the United States and how it impacts U.S. foreign policy. And I was wondering if you could begin by looking at maybe your most recent work with FOR, but looking at over your life of activism, could you share with us in terms of the awareness of Islam and in terms of activism, in terms of how it has impacted organizing in the last couple of decades among peace and justice workers here?
Well, thank you for that opportunity. First, I want to say that Islam is a faith and a religion that is not new to the North American scene, and usually when I have an opportunity to share this with folks, I let people know that the first Muslims who came to North America did not come on slave ships. They, in fact, came as explorers from the Mali Empire in the year 1311 of the Christian calendar, and evidence of their transmigration across the Atlantic and landing in what is now Mexico is found in many archaeological and historical records of trade and harmonious relationships between these explorers who came across on 200 ships and the indigenous people of Mexico and in Central America. More recently, Muslims came in large numbers during the transatlantic slave trade, where many scholars like Dr. Ivan Van Sertum and others assert that about 20%, as many as 20% of the Africans who were captured and brought to the New World as slaves were in fact Muslim. And then now we see in the early 20th century, emerging into the 21st century, a new wave of immigration and awareness of the existence of perhaps 7 to 9 million Muslims in the United States of America from all different ethnic and racial and national groups. In the area of organizing, I would argue that a major impact started in the 60s with the awareness mm-hmm. of Islam in the African-American community through the life and the advocacy and the work of Malcolm X, of Hajj Malik al-Shabazz. And that certainly invigorated and energized a large segment of the Black Liberation Movement, but also people who were and are working on community development projects, health programs, programs that offer human service, programs for formerly incarcerated people, and a wide, wide spectrum of concerns that impact on day-to-day life in the United States. Muslims are now, of course, much more heavily scrutinized and questioned in the aftermath of the events of September 11, 2001. But in addition to the negative view of Islam as a result of those actions, there's also a greater openness to have dialogue with and exchange with Muslims in the context of our shared faith and elements of faith with the Christian and Jewish communities, but also in recognizing that Muslims are not monolithic and that Muslims have not only internal diversity, but also a great deal of value to offer the Abrahamic conversation and, I would argue, the conversation for justice in the United States and globally.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and myself, Celeste, and we're speaking with Ibrahim Rahmi, who is from the Fellowship of Reconciliation, Peace, and is the Disarmament Coordinator. Ibrahim, you mentioned an explosion, if you will, of consciousness and activity in the 60s, pretty much, with the concept and the theology of Islam, but in terms of the grassroots citizen in America, in terms of some of the bedrock levels of political activity, was this also America's first real introduction to the cultures of the East and the Orient and Islam?
I think largely that's true. There were two major mass movements in the African descendant or black community in the 20th century that were Islamic in form. One was the Moorish American Science Temple under the leadership of Noble Jua Ali, which had its advent in the mid-1920s, and the other, of course, was the Nation of Islam, or the so-called Black Muslims, who were followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and had their advent and origins in 1930 and, of course, exist today. But the political recognition of Islam, I argue, started largely with the realization of the work and the life of Malcolm. The current reality, of course, is a little bit different because we have not only African-American Muslims, who are about 40% or so of the national population of Muslims in America, but we have Muslims from everywhere else in the world, including indigenous people, Latinos, Latinas, people of European ancestry, and so on. So there is now, I think, a wider recognition of both the plurality within Islam and, secondly, the fact that Islam maintains a presence in the Americas and a presence in the United States of America that, while certainly diverse and not centered on any particular ideology, is nonetheless a faith community that has to be reckoned with and understood and engaged with. So there's a, particularly after 9/11, a more open theological and social engagement with Muslims on areas of not only theology and religion, but also things of practical interest, that is, voter registration and community health projects, and, as I mentioned, all kinds of service outreaches to people in need, of what, including Muslims, both as the beneficiaries of services, but also increasingly as providers of those services.
You mentioned that, again, that pretty much for the United States consciousness, this was an experience that came through communities of color, more notably Black Americans, even though now you find expressions of Islam within Asian communities, as you said, Latino communities and beyond. How do you think the current view of Islam is affected by the fact that for many Americans, their first introduction did come through people of color, communities of color?
I think that Islam has been viewed within the context of sort of American racism, if you will, and American colorism, as a non-Western, non-Abrahamic, alien religion. In fact, many people are surprised to know that the name for our Lord, Allah, is simply an Arabic name for God, and that Arab Christians also call God Allah. So this, we are not worshiping an alien deity or a deity outside of the revealed text of Christianity. I think also, as you point out the issue of race, there's also the long tradition of xenophobia within the United States. That is, that some people who come to America tend to be more easily accepted and readily acceptable over time because they are people of European ancestry, whereas a lot of the rest of us who are, you know, myself, an African American or Latinos or Asians and others, have both faced legal exclusion through exclusive immigration laws and also social exclusion through the fact that the social contract of assimilation and quote-unquote becoming American, unquote, doesn't really apply to people of color in the same way that it applies to white folk. So Muslims, on top of all that, have that extra whammy of coming from a faith tradition and faith community that has a long history, to some extent, of contention with the West, going back to the Crusades in the 11th century, through the Ottoman Empire, and now through another wave of contention over the expansion of the American Empire in areas that are rich in petroleum and that also happen to be inhabited by large Muslim populations. All those things, I think, add to a mixture of some reservation, if not outright contempt and hatred. But I'd have to say, honestly, on the other side, there are people in larger numbers who are beginning to recognize that Muslims are not alien, either in theological or in community terms, to the North American reality, and that very often your chiropractor, your cab driver, your local vendor, the electrical engineer that's running your power plant, will be people who leave on Friday afternoon and make prayer as Muslims. They are religious people.
We're speaking this morning with Ibrahim Rami of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and he's a longtime activist. And we invite your listening ears and to join us in conversations or questions later on in this program. One thing, I was wondering if you could share some more in terms of your work, particularly talking about how your work has changed since September 11th. You've been an activist for a long time in terms of peace and justice issues, and it's been my experience that oftentimes people have different understandings or misunderstandings of peoples and faith. And I was wondering, particularly in terms of the activist community, have you encountered different thoughts or opinions about who you are or who you represent among, say, progressives or peace activists?
And how does that affect your activism?
Well, I believe that, let me get to Celeste. Celeste has a very central question, and let me, if I can try to address that first, I'll do that. But I would say to you that my activism increasingly, as I become more mature and a little wiser, comes out of faith rather than looking at faith coming out of activism. I believe in Allah, and I am seeking to practice my religion, my way of life, in a manner that is befitting my love of the Creator and my belief in the tenets of Islam, which are tenets of justice and mutuality and mercy and compassion. And that becomes a bedrock of how I see myself as a man, as a black man, as an activist, as a professional, as any other part of my identity within this complex society that we live in. But more than that, I believe that the overall community within the United States has become much more critically aware of Islam as a religion within the mix of American religions, but also much more curious about how Muslims might engage in the kind of things that other activists do. So, for example, when we talk about the ethic of environmental responsibility and climate crisis, and I am a board member also of the National Climate Crisis Coalition, Muslims engage in work around that based upon our idea of the stewardship of creation that was given to human beings by the Almighty. And it's mentioned in the Quran on a number of different places in the Quran. So we would come to environmental work, for example, working side by side with many non-Muslims, but come to that work with a very clear orientation that is guided by the faith and by what we believe to be the commandment that God gave all of humankind in terms of stewardship and responsibility for the natural world. Now, a non-religious person, or certainly a non-Muslim, might say that there's just empirical evidence that says that the planet's getting warmer and that the ice caps are melting and that, you know, super hurricanes are coming as a result of global warming. But where we would agree and where we would converge outside of faith would be in the recognition that people, regardless of our religious identity or non-identity, have a mutual responsibility to all of mankind, all of humankind. And it's in that recognition of mutuality that Muslims find a place to connect to the civil rights struggles, to the environmental struggles, arguably also to struggles around demilitarization, disarmament, the abolition of nuclear weapons, and so on.
Wait. Yeah, it's kind of difficult sometimes when you're talking to someone over the phone and waiting for that pause. Are you?
Yeah.
And in terms of, let me just shift it a little bit in terms of your work, and I'm trying to get an understanding of what does it mean for a person of faith to engage with people of no faith in the type of work you do? Are there times when people either question your commitment to justice issues because you're a person of faith? Is there times you have to wrestle with that? Are there times when there are meetings or activities that you have to absent yourself because of your faith? And how does that interact with those who are otherwise activists?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing that sometimes faith can be a catalyst for a deeper understanding of other human beings through just sharing and listening, and sometimes it becomes that wall and that place that people don't want to go to because they recognize that my faith is different from theirs, or my commitment may be based on a different set of spiritual principles than theirs. There's a point at which people converge in activist work around issues of, as I mentioned earlier, mutual human concern and survival. So nuclear weapons, for example, would be a great place to have, or the abolition of nuclear weapons, rather, would be a great place for people of different and no faith communities and commitments to come together and begin to work on practical things. But it does become somewhat problematic when, for example, you are invited to speak someplace and there's a buffet dinner that has, you know, ham and, you know, all kinds of stuff that you can't eat because people who know that you're Muslim didn't bother to ask whether the dietary laws that you follow as a Muslim would be would allow you to eat certain things that are being served. There's also, I think, a growing tendency for secularization, if there's such a word, within major social change movements that tend to look at religious folk and people of faith as either being out of step with progressive and revolutionary change, or simply people who are simply not enlightened enough or informed enough to get rid of their faith baggage so they can do real work. So there has been a friend of mine who is a Muslim woman, brilliant Muslim woman, whom I work with a lot, has mentioned that she'll be speaking about issues related to women or feminism and on a panel discussion, for example, and someone after the panel will come up to her and say, you know, gee, you're a really smart woman, you have a master's degree, you've been all over the world. Why are you still a Muslim? As if somehow being a Muslim woman is antithetical to being an intelligent activist who is also a female. So there's a great deal of mutual disconnect from what faith means and how it informs us and how it motivates us and how it deepens our love for not only the Lord of creation, but also all of humankind. And I think it's only through the kind of dialogue and open communication through media that we're having right now on KABU that we'll be able to bridge the understanding gap. And when I say that, I mean that I don't ever believe that people can or should try to convert other people to their religion or their persuasion. But I do think that there is a great deal of room, particularly within the kind of world that I'd like to live in, for folk of different persuasions or non-persuasions to base mutual coexistence and respect on that kind of exchange of what we differ in as well as what we agree to. So that there is, for me as a Muslim and an activist and a black person and an advocate of different policies, room in my world to include everyone on some level who's working for social change, but also recognizing that I will work for social change as a Muslim, and that needs to be understood and respected.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. If you'd like to join in the conversation with Ibrahim Rami, you can do so by dialing 503-231-8187. You brought up some interesting points, and I'd like to kind of shift gears in a sense and look at points of connection, points of disconnect, expressions of faith, perspectives of faith, by first saying, well, there's essentially three very broad categories of Muslims in the United States: those who are immigrants, those who are American citizens who are converts or reverts to Islam, and then those who are born as children to either one of those groups. Is there any particular experience, especially within the progressive community, that's really different from Muslims in the U.S.? Or maybe I should take that the progressive community out and just say broadly. Is there a really distinct experience of being Muslim in the United States? And does that United States citizenry, does that change in some way or affect the values and beliefs of those who were born here but also born into Islam? I get the feeling that there's a slight shift. I don't want to call it a disconnect, but a slight shift in perspectives.
That's true. And I think it's fair to say that people who are indigenous to the United States, born here, mostly people of African ancestry or first-generation Muslims from some other part of the world, have a sort of different cultural overlay in their practice because they have evolved both personally through a set of experiences that did not find its origins in Pakistan or India or Saudi Arabia or Senegal. It rather happened within the multicultural, multiracial, multi-class context of the United States of America itself. Many of us, for example, like myself, came up, and I've been interested in Islam from the age of 20 years old on up, but my political experiences and my political socialization actually happened through the Black Liberation Movement and not through an Islamic movement. However, that being said, there are major differences within how the what I'll call the American Muslim community might view certain issues. You have people, for example, who are very, very conservative and supporters of the current regime in Washington, and who want to practice their religion but want to do it within a racial and class context that does not challenge the current power relationships in the society. And you also have people who, like myself, who come out of a more radical, you know, African-American tradition, who would definitely challenge those assumptions and those relationships based not only on Islam, but also on the commitment against racism and economic injustice in the United States. That's clearly a motivating force in my life and in the lives of many of the people that I work with and know and care about. So there are those great disparities in worldview and in analysis and in response within the community of Muslims born in America, as well as those same divisions and dissimilarities among the community of folk who've been born somewhere else and who come here. So I guess what I'm getting at is that Islam is a very plural religion in its not just ethnic makeup and cultural makeup, but also in its worldview and analysis. Now, what I will say to back on the other side of that answer is that Muslims do or ought to share very common values regarding faith and the reverence toward God, the belief in the building of community, justice for not only ourselves but for all of humankind, environmental stewardship, and this will be a shocker, the resolution of conflict through means other than violence. Mm-hmm. So all those things are also tenets of the religion and practical expressions of the religion that should be and are largely held as common threads that unite Muslims across these different divisions.
You mentioned, and I think it's important in terms of the diversity of, among Muslims, and your last point when you was talking about the resolution of conflict through nonviolent means, I'm familiar with most particularly the Christian tradition, and well familiar with the range of perspectives on that, from just war Christians to those who are pacifist in terms of the diversity of beliefs and how to resolve conflicts. Could you also speak something about the diversity within the Muslim community around resolution of conflict? Is there a, for lack of a better term, just war theory as well as a pacifist theory within the Muslim faith?
There are traditions within Islam that both embrace the use of warfare under certain traditions and certain very narrowly defined circumstances, and also traditions that would reject warfare as being unjust. Now, to go to the first example, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was able to organize a community of people largely because of not only faith but also of the willingness of the community to engage in social justice work with the religious other. Jihad, as it was defined in the original tenets of the Quran, was very limited and only applied in the military sense when the life and existence of the Muslim community was threatened by an external force, and only when other means had been exhausted. So jihad was never about forced conversion or terrorism or killing civilians. It was purely, in the original configuration of it, a defensive survival strategy to be employed only, again, as a means of last resort. Now, of course, people have twisted it to include the prosecution of warfare against civilians or political rivals or national enemies and so on. But jihad has never, it originally was not intended to be that. And we have to, as Muslims who are oriented toward peace and justice, say that the distortion of the meaning of jihad by extremists within the religion cannot be used as a blanket condemnation of all Muslims or the tenets of Islam. The peace dimension of Islam is less well known. We don't have within Islam, for example, the articulated development of a peace church in the same way that you have Quakers and Mennonites and Catholics in the peace tradition and mm-hmm. Church of the Brethren folk and so on. But there are examples historically, many, many examples historically. Most recently in our political memory in the Indian independence struggle and the rise of a personality known as Shah Bhagwan Shah, sometimes called the Muslim Gandhi, that articulate a view that justice can be won through struggle that does not involve armed conflict and warfare. And there are many, many examples in different texts and historical treatises of how Muslims have come together to fight for justice without going to the length of picking up weapons to kill other people. We here at the Muslim Peace Fellowship, which of course is a program or a dimension and a affiliate of the larger Fellowship of Reconciliation, are advocates of that tradition, and also people who promote the idea that as Muslims we can work for justice, struggle for justice, advocate for justice in many, many ways that do not involve and should not involve any kind of warfare or killing. And in fact, that is becoming much more of a discourse within the Muslim world, and I believe, God willing, will become a dominant conversation within the Muslim world, as we hope it will be within the Christian world as well.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio. Join the conversation, 503-231-8187. It's a good chance to make your call if you're someone who listens a lot but doesn't have an opportunity to call in. The lines are available, so this is your chance. We've talked a little bit about some of the different expressions of peace within, and the peace movement, I guess I'll say, within the Muslim community. I'm a little curious, not being as well-versed as some, is whether or not you find this particular perspective more in communities that have undergone some kind of political, I don't want to say revolution in terms of a very violent struggle, but still a clash with regard to maybe political and personal freedoms. Is this idea of a more pronounced peace movement something that's come out of communities or countries wherein you had either a colonial clash or are just people who have been dealing with various forms of oppression.
I think so. And I think always when people are traumatized by massive amounts of violence in any part of the world, there will be a rise of those who say enough is enough is enough. In Israel-Palestine, for example, where you have a long tradition of both mutual hostility between two communities and also what I would argue is a broad anti-colonial, anti-occupation struggle on the part of a people, the people of Palestine, there has emerged a movement, granted not a well-known movement, not a movement that attracts ABC Nightly News or CNN or C-SPAN, but a movement nonetheless among Palestinians, and I also have to say among Israelis as well, that is attempting to define the terms of building justice without resorting to the continuation of violence. As a matter of fact, we here at FOR this past March hosted a visit from a young Israeli man named Yonatan Shapira, who's a former Air Force pilot and now is the co-founder of something called Combatants for Peace, which is a Israeli and Palestinian collaboration made up of former combatants and armed soldiers on both sides who are now striving to build relationships to work against the occupation and work for peace without resorting to warfare. So here's an example, and again I raise the example in the Jewish and Islamic context, of people who have come out of fighting each other, shooting at each other, and are now saying that we can't do this anymore, there's got to be a better way. And all throughout the world, you know, for example, in Rwanda, and another example is the fact that in the Rwandan genocide of 1994, which killed, by UN estimates, I think about 800,000, mostly Tutsi ethnic people in Rwanda, the small Islamic community in Rwanda was a beacon of hope and refuge for many Tutsis, to the point where last year the New York Times ran an article, front page article, on the growth of Islam in this little nation of Rwanda, largely because people saw the Muslim community in Rwanda as a peacemaking and mediating community that gave shelter mm-hmm. to people who were being pursued in a genocide. These are just two examples of how Muslims and other religious partners come out of horrific conflict with a commitment to create justice and structures and institutions that are justice building without resorting to violence and conflict.
We're speaking this morning with Ibrahim Rami of the Fellowship of Reconciliation and Muslim Peace Fellowship, and around issues that we are all concerned about. I think it would be negligent on our part if we ended our conversation before touching about the so-called war on terror and its impact on our nation and on your work. Certainly, 9/11 was a significant shift for many Americans, and I guess for many Americans, the image of the President of the United States proclaiming we have this enemy, this unseen enemy, it's a war on terror, which I think he tends to be very sophisticated enough to be very subtle in terms of language, mm-hmm. But for many of us, war on terror means war on Islam, and that's how it plays out on, you know, in barbershop conversations and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
How do you view this so-called war on terror, and what was a proper response to it as an American and also as a person active in peace and justice issues?
I have a few responses, actually, as one of my good friends, Imam Akhti Bray in Washington, always talks about the dangers of driving while black and flying while Muslim. And if you're both, you know, you definitely get it from both sides. On the real tip, though, I would say that the war on terror, as it's being promoted by the Bush administration, in my estimation, and again, I'm not speaking for anybody but Ibrahim, that war basically fits into a much larger strategic plan that began you could argue from 1492 until the present day, but that has its more immediate origins in the period right after the the first major Arab oil embargo, OPEC oil embargo of 1974, mm-hmm. when the chess pieces for global intervention and the expansion of U.S. military and corporate interest in the Middle East began to really consolidate. And the war on terror, as we know it, is, I believe, a part of a larger strategy for the extension of U.S. corporate and military power. This is not, of course, to say that there are not people in the world who do things that are abominable and cruel and violent, and do them in spectacular ways that are clearly visible to the global media and the global population because of mass media, and that kill people, and that kill people in ways that are totally unjustifiable and wrong and morally abominable. Those things do happen. But I'll make one point, and that is simply that as people like Iqbal Ahmed and others have pointed, this is hardly a unilateral Muslim phenomenon, that if one goes back to, for example, in our own history, the period of time between 1980 and 1990, roughly, when 200,000 or so people in Latin America, mostly Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and El Salvador, were murdered by death squads, bought and financed and trained at the School of the Americas, mm-hmm. and given political and economic support by the United States, that this was terrorism, and this is terrorism, but it's not a form of terrorism that people in the North American reality recognize as being the product of American policy and deliberate American action. So I would say that global terrorism needs to be totally uprooted, regardless of the religious identity of the people committing these acts. The second point I'll make is that these actions are not exclusive to Muslims, and in fact have been a very real and unacknowledged part of the history of the United States of America as well, and that we need, as progressives and people of conscience, to say that the American variant of, you know, killing innocent people is not justified and can't be covered by a flag. And the third thing is that if we are interested in ending violence, we have to also put resources into building economic justice and structures that look at solutions beyond violence. And that's why, as a practical example, I would say that every person in the United States should back the proposal by Representative Dennis Kucinich to create a federal cabinet-level Department of Peace that would be funded by 1% of the budget that we give to the Pentagon, so that every year $4 to $5 billion of our tax money would go to create conflict resolution programs and nonviolent intervention programs and programs that actually address civil conflict and economic injustice through nonviolent and peaceful means. And if we invest in that, then we'll ultimately see the phenomenon of terrorism becoming less and less and less of a global concern, because people won't need to do that. We won't need to sacrifice American lives fighting people in the world, and the people who are killing American people in the world will have less and less and less and less reasons to engage in that kind of activity. So I think it has to be worked at through both ends. Now let me briefly say that we do need to have effective global police structures that can identify and intervene in situations where people are either being subject to genocide or subject to terrorism. I believe that's true. And a great deal of that intervention could begin by choking off the international arms trade, of which the United States is the largest partner and participant. So that's how I see it.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Ibrahim Rami of the Fellowship of Reconciliation and the Muslim Peace Fellowship. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. And you've had this very peaceful effect on our radio station this morning, that, you know, people are listening.
I think people become speculative and consider and sitting here and thinking. Because generally, this would be, I could see people really having been engaged in a more excitable context. We've talked a lot about just the experience of being a Muslim in the United States, some of the differences, some of the similarities in both the faith and in the need for a social, I'll call it revolution, if you will. But in terms of government, we haven't really addressed if there are any significant differences in how government interacts. And given the fact that you find within the practice of Islam, there are many more intersections between faith and daily activities. Are there any significant differences in government or in politics that you'd like to mention?
When you say, I want to make sure I understand the question. When you say differences in governments, difference in
between Islamic models of government and say Western United States or Western-based models of government.
Well, I want to say something that might be radical and that a lot of people might challenge or think is just totally off the wall, but and I've been accused of that more than once in my life, as you can imagine. But I would argue that there are no genuinely Islamic governments or models of governance that exist today. There are governments that are Islamic in form, Saudi Arabia as a great example, Iran as an example, but not Islamic in essence, as in embodying the spirit and the true revelation of Quran. In Islam, there are two major bodies of guidance. One is the revealed text of the Quran, which is our sacred book. And the other is what we call hadith, which is the text of prophetic tradition. And to the extent that any government that calls itself Islamic would, for example, violate the human rights of non-Muslims. Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay,
that's one of our other lines.
If that government would violate the rights of women, violate the rights of non-Muslims, wage war upon innocent people, engage in actions of brutality or illegal arrest and torture, as we see in Saudi Arabia and the torture rendition between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, that those governments are not genuinely Islamic and Muslim. Now, that doesn't mean that Muslims don't have responsibility to deal with them, because we do. But I would argue again, and again from a personal perspective.
We're having some difficulties. Continue speaking.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I would argue that those governments and the ways in which those governments interact with their citizens are not genuinely Islamic or Muslim. Now, they may be Muslim again in form, but in the same way, for example, that a true Christian government would not allow illegal detention of people without fair trial, would not allow for this great disparity between wealth and poverty, would not have thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons aimed at other people as weapons of mass destruction. A true follower of Christ would find some, if not all, of those things to be an abomination in the eyes of God. Likewise, I believe that there are governments that call themselves Muslim that or Islamic that do not embody the spirit or the letter of Islamic law, particularly as they relate to the coexistence with and the human rights of the religious other. So if one goes to Nigeria, for example, one will find Muslims and Christians. But if you go to any part of Nigeria where a regional government or a state government within the Nigerian federal system doesn't allow the religious freedom of Christians to live outside of Muslim law, then I would argue that that Muslim government is not functioning in a way that is Islamic. We have to bring to a global consciousness an understanding of what Islamic law really is.
Mm-hmm.
And that law says that people are not compelled to bow down to a religion that is not one of their choice. There is no compulsion of religion. If I believe strongly in my faith, but I also believe that people have a right to have a faith or a non-faith of their choice, and that there can be no compulsion in that. So that would be my short answer. And I think that what really is happening right now in the alignment of governments around against or for American policy is that it's not so much an alignment around Islam versus Christianity, mm-hmm. but rather an alignment around either the policies of an imperial system that's expanding throughout mm-hmm. the world and mm-hmm. gobbling up resources, yeah. or alignment around a very diverse collection of groups of people who challenge that imperial system, even when they have their own internal contradictions.
Excellent. Well, we have a couple of callers online, so we'll try to get to them. And good morning, caller. You are on the air. Thank you for waiting.
Good morning. Hello?
Morning.
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Turn down your radio and speak into the telephone.
Okay, since we've lost that caller, we'll go to our next one. Good morning. You're on the air.
Well, good morning, Cecil, Celeste.
Good morning.
Is a fascinating discussion. I wanted to bring up Mogadishu. What recently happened in Mogadishu, Somalia, a group called the Islamic Courts literally took power away from warlords, which the United States has been supporting some of. And I find that fascinating, and I wanted to compare that quickly with the Katrina story, where Christian groups moved in and took care of so many of the needs. These are both of these traditions, the Islamic courts, which are apparently not Islamists in Mogadishu, and then the Christians from the Salvation Army, for instance, in the Katrina aftermath. These are examples of the faith-based tradition that is purely justice, peace, let's get things set in order and make sure that our fellow men are doing okay. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's what I had to say. Maybe your guest can comment on that.
Thank you so much for your call.
You. Yes.
Yes, and thank you, and salam alaikum, and peace to our listener. I wanted to point out that the charitable tradition within Islam is a deeply held one, going back to the roots of Islam through the revelation of Quran and the Prophet Muhammad, alayhi salam, peace upon him. And when I was in Sudan last year, we were, my small delegation of Muslims, Christians, and a rabbi, were able to see Islamic Relief as a global Islamic relief organization engaging in orphanages and building food centers and having water projects throughout Islam, not only relative to and serving the Muslim majority population of Sudan, but also serving Christians and people of other faiths as well. In the best traditions, we find that people follow the belief that compassion and mercy is compelled upon us, that and basically required of us by God Almighty. And that means mm-hmm. that the compassion and mercy that we see all over the world, in the Muslim and Christian world, is really disconnected from the political strife mm-hmm. and divisions. And it's really human-centered compassion based upon yeah. our deep belief that God Almighty, however we worship God, calls upon us to do that with regard to human need in our community and in any other community. So I would certainly say that the best of Islamic traditions mm-hmm. in this country and the world are those traditions that mirror the things that are happening in Somalia of a positive nature, the things happening in Sudan of a positive nature, and other places.
But speaking of that aspect, charitable organizations, certainly in recent years, some charitable organization have been questioned in terms of their relationships, in terms of their honesty, and it's my understanding that many Muslims have been under suspect because of where they donate money, or
yes.
certain organizations have been under
scrutiny for collecting monies, and those monies have been said to be used in support of terrorist activities.
Well, you know, there's a whole I don't even know how to say it, but I think that the security apparatus and the Justice Department of the United States has basically taken a mm-hmm. meat axe approach to the idea of attacking Muslim charities and then sorting out the truth later on.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the legitimate work of people who are feeding orphans and providing assistance to folk in need is being truncated and destroyed, even while the illicit transfer of arms, for example, or money for weapons, And certainly that takes place in the U.S., not only between Muslims and people overseas, but between, you know, people from Eastern Europe, you know, people who have different ethnic loyalties in the former Yugoslavia, for example, mm-hmm. who've been busted for that kind of stuff.
Sure.
So it's not so much the religious motivation, it's just the fact that the closing down of Muslim charities mm-hmm. has been, from our perspective, largely overwhelmingly unjust and without empirical evidence to back up these claims by the Justice Department, and that further it's been part of what we talked about earlier in the broader attempt to attack and delegitimize and in some ways isolate the Muslim community in the United States, because there are people who, sadly, largely on the political right, want to paint all Muslims with the same brush and not discern that this is a community that's not overwhelmingly engaged in the kind of activity that it's being accused of.
You know, that's just very ironic given the fact that this is the administration of the faith-based cooperative.
And we have another caller online, so we'll go to that caller. Good morning, caller. Are you there? You are on the air.
Well, good morning. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.
Okay, here's my take. There's been a rash of suicides, I understand, on corporate TV over at Guantanamo. I believe three or four prisoners hung themselves in their cells, which just tears my heart out. It's unbelievable how the government or the military are treating people of Islamic faith. Locally, we can see what happened to Brandon Mayfield simply because the man followed Islam. He was arrested. His life was turned upside down by some bogus suspicion that they found his fingerprints somewhere in Spain, and he hasn't left the country in 10 years. A real scary thing I heard on KBOO a few months ago about the army holding maneuvers off of 217 about 200 or 300 yards away from a mosque
mm-hmm.
for no apparent reason other than to harass the parishioners. And on and on it goes, from the chaplain, from the Muslim chaplain who was incarcerated at Guantanamo for bogus charges
of espionage, right?
Yeah, kept in solitary confinement for 72 hours.
Green James Key.
Although his superior officers filled his file with letters of commendation, right? Time after time after time, he finally resigned from the military with a letter of commendation, but no apology for the behavior of the government of the government.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and
let me
up to us as a community. I do not follow the Islamic faith. I affectionately call myself a Jubu. Translation is I'm a Jewish Buddhist. And how can we as a community stand together, right, and tell the people who run the show that their behavior and their obvious discrimination against our Muslim brothers and sisters is unacceptable? And thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you for your call. Ibrahim?
Well, thank you for making that very clear pronouncement regarding the activities of the government in Guantanamo. We have said, and when I say we, I mean persons like me and Muslim human and civil rights organizations like the Muslim American Society Freedom Foundation and many, many, many others have taken an active stand on the torture rendition and the activities of Guantanamo as we did in Abu Ghraib in Iraq. And we've called upon the government of the United States to honor its international treaty obligations around torture, as well as the process of legality in our own system that says that people can't be arrested without being tried or at least charged, and that people have a right to legal representation, and that the idea of quote-unquote arresting enemy combatants does not negate or in any way nullify the human rights of the people being detained. So what has to happen, I would argue, and again speaking for myself, is that we need to work for regime change on the first Tuesday of November of 2008, because the activity of the Justice Department very clearly is not in accordance with our understanding of constitutional legal law or human rights. The second thing that we want to do is just to continue to lift up in our prayers and our actions the detainees in Guantanamo, the unknown number of detainees throughout the world in secret CIA prisons, the people who are being held in Iraq without due process, and a wide community of folk throughout the world who are not given the right of defending themselves, representing themselves, or even having the so-called witnesses against them brought into a court of law so that they can be faced by the accused.
Exactly.
There is a cardinal principle of American law. I'm not a lawyer, but I do know that part of American justice is predicated on the right of accused people to see and confront those who bring evidence against them. And if that's not honored, then we don't have a legal system that's honorable.
Well,
which may be
kind
of like, you know, like overstating the obvious, but
yeah,
I think it's something that needs to be said.
We do have one more caller online, and we'll go to our caller. Thank you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. I just wanted to thank you all for this incredible dialogue and discussion, this opportunity, really. I was just going to say that if one thing that this administration has accomplished for me is it's killed off the need for me to continue searching for Christianity in my life. It's been very hard to be any type of a peace activist and still trying to retain that need for Christianity in one's life. And I just, it's been very difficult as a woman, as a mother, to try and justify what the Bible, this Christian Western Bible, tells me. And especially now with this government and how it's using the Bible, not only against the Iraqis and against the world or anybody who doesn't, but it's anybody who doesn't agree with their agenda. And I went to the Fleet Week with several different organizations to protest the militarization of just about everything in this country. And what we saw there was this marriage of Christianity and military. Right next to the recruiters' tents were these Christian Bible tents.
Mm-hmm.
And we had this one guy telling us that we were commies and we were going to hell, and he was saying that he was a soldier for Christ right next to the Marine recruiter station.
Mm-hmm.
Who would Jesus kill, huh?
The more each day goes by with the Gestapo regime, the more I realize that we are the fundamental extremist. We are the terrorist. We are the ones oppressing everybody in this world. And I just, it'd be like me trying to be an environmentalist while going to environmental marches in a Hummer, throwing out litter from my car. I just can no longer. So I denounced the need to search for Christianity in my heart. It doesn't mean I'm anti-Christian. I just, it's most of the Christianity is really against me, and everything I try to find in that Bible is just so far what I'm trying to teach my kids and how I'm trying to live my life. Like, thou shalt not torture, you know, and thou shalt not kill, and just being a woman and someone who wants peace. I had to finally say enough is enough. I don't want this.
Well, I'm very grateful
that you were here and were telling us a few things about your faith and your ways and how you can combine your spirituality with the peace movement, because we all need these lessons, and we're all just kind of newbies at this and trying. So
okay, well, thank you
very much. Bye.
Okay.
Bye. Thank you. Well, I have to say that as a person who was raised as an African-American Southern Christian and raised by Southern rural parents in Virginia for the first 20-odd years of my life, I can tell you that the Christianity of my community and my Bible experiences as a youth are very different, apparently, from those of George Bush, although I must say that George Bush and I happened to graduate from the same high school, not in the same year, but from the same high school in Massachusetts. The problem has always been for religion what happens when religion fails and when you conflate racism and greed and empire and intolerance and hatred into religious thought and come out with something that tries to be pseudo-religious but in fact is quite the opposite. And that's something that can happen for Christians and Muslims and Jews and Buddhists and Hindus. Well, not so much Buddhists, I don't think. Certainly not Baha'is, at least as far as I can see. But many of the major religions, I think, have a problem. So I would suggest for our listener that the path to faith is obviously a very deeply individual one. And it only happens when there's a great deal of discernment and prayer and internal struggle. But at the same time, I would have to say that there are those followers of Christ who are righteous and good and believing people who love, in my opinion, the Jesus of the Bible and not the Jesus of Constantine or George Bush. Not the imperial Jesus, but the Jesus of compassion and love for all humanity that truly, as I experienced Jesus, came as a way and a true way to redemption through love of God. And it's in that dimension of Christianity that I find my own Islamic identity being strengthened and better informed, that my my understanding of the Buddhist Dharma strengthens and informs my identity. My understanding of the Baha'i text strengthens and informs my identity. And I do that as I say that as a Muslim, but also as a person who can appreciate that all traditions have within them the seeds not only of destruction and degradation, but also the received seeds of redemption and love and mutuality. And it's on those other seeds that I choose to build faith, and hopefully my tree of faith will be able to not just germinate but grow.
Thank you so much for your inspiring words and also for your work. We have to let you go, but I hope you continue your good work, and we thank you for your faithful work and your call to peace and justice.
And building bridges.
I look forward to seeing both of you one day when I'm in Oregon.
Okay.
God bless everyone.
All righty.
Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Have a good morning.
You too. And coming up this morning at KBOO at 9 on the OMO Variety Hour, hear about the war in Iraq and review the film Occupation Dreamland. 10, Dr. Naaman interview a naturopathic physician and acupuncturist about the role of natural therapies in sports medicine and injury rehabilitations. Yay, World Cup.
All
at
right.
10:30 on the Dirtbag, the topic is certified organic. Not just organic.
Certified organic.
Tom Goodwin of Oregon Tilth Farm Program discusses organic farming practices and products, recent rule changes, and takes on your questions. And at 11 is, you know what, Democracy Now! Amy Goodman speaks with an attorney for the Guantanamo detainees and former Army chaplain James Yee. And leading American psychiatrist Dr. Robert J. Lipton talked about the psychological dimensions of war and occupations and the roles of doctors in interrogation and torture.
And there you have it, news that you and our community can use. We want you to stay tuned to KBOO-FM here in Portland and beyond, because we are your community connection, and we will hear you next week.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories, which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com. Stay tuned for the Old Mole Variety Hour.